Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 18. It features Jonathan Litt, who I have known for quite a bit. I've known him since Tron. I work with him on that, and he is one of the smartest people I know, to be honest. I've known a lot of smart people. I have several of them on this podcast, but Jonathan is up there, and we cover so many things in this podcast that the problem with my conversations with John is that we always end up going down the rabbit hole about some subject because we can really get in depth on things. And I constantly have to stop the conversation so that we can move on to the next subject of some kind so we run out of time. So what I urge you guys to do is listen to it several times if you can. Tell me if there's parts that you want to bring John back and talk about more, because he is really an amazing guy, and you'll see all the subjects we cover here are incredible. From his early days at ILM to skin shaders to different lighting techniques to his passion for VR and all kinds of subjects. So let me know what you guys think and leave us your comments, your tweets. You guys now know what to do. Thanks, guys.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the chaos group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
You and I have worked for a long time together, and we've known each other. We've been good friends for a long time. But what was funny was one of the first things I heard about you in terms of what you've done in the past was actually through a podcast. It was an FX Guide podcast with... who was it? Was
Ben
it?
Snow?
Ben Snow, yeah.
Okay, yeah. And I think that's the only...
Only thing
time I've ever been mentioned on a podcast, so I figured that must be the one.
Yeah. And it was for Galaxy Quest.
Yep.
So you worked on Galaxy Quest?
I did. Yeah.
That's a pretty awesome movie. What were you doing on that movie?
That was my first show as sort of a full-fledged artist because I started at ILM as a entry level job to get my foot in the door.
Right.
And, it was sort of a graveyard shift, dealing with watching renders and stuff like that. And that was during the Phantom Menace and some other movies as well, that era.
So you were basically a render wrangler, or is that
basically a render wrangler?
So you really kind of work your way up at ILM. Right?
I did. Yeah. I mean, the thing is I used the time wisely because, I would sit and watch renders, and just at any night, there'd be many, many things running, and I would just sort of find the most interesting things and just see how they worked.
Yeah.
And also we had a lot more leeway, and companies nowadays maybe don't do this as much. I don't know if they still do this at ILM, but, we were encouraged to try to figure out what was wrong in the scenes and actually open up the tools and figure out why stuff was failing and then call the artists up and say, hey, we think we might know what's going on here.
Right.
And we'd be spending hours on the phone every night talking to people. And then there was a whole system where the artists could enter the hours that they wanted to be called, or maybe not at all.
Right.
And some of them would say, call me 24 hours, call me at 4 a.m. I don't care. Some would say, please don't call me after 8 a.m. or 8 p.m.
Yep.
So it was a pretty well-run system of if someone wanted remote help, they could get it. And so I was spending that time learning how everything worked and digging into the bowels of the system.
That's actually a good call for anyone who's really out there looking to be a render wrangler of some kind. It's your opportunity to really learn. I mean, there's really no better opportunity to learn than to do that.
Yeah.
A good company will set that system up for you to do that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean,
and listen to podcasts too.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and it's just like you could think of it as like a film set too. I mean, the people, if you're on a film set, you have every opportunity to go as far as you want because you're you could be watching Spielberg direct. I mean, you might be a PA,
right?
And but you're in the presence and seeing it all happen of the greats, mm-hmm. or even maybe not the greats, but right. Yeah, I think, you know, if you have a job like that and you don't just think of it as, well, I just have these duties on this job, I'm just going to do these duties, but you use the time, and that's sort of the classic,
right?
You know, entertainment business way. But if you use that time wisely, you'll learn a lot.
What I've also learned is when I work with an artist who came from the wrangling side of things, they tend to be the most efficient coming in, because they know, like, yeah. no, you got to make sure these, and like, they've learned like what makes something go fast and what makes it efficient, as opposed to, oh, I accidentally put something on the farm that takes 17 hours of rain.
Yeah. And I mean, the other thing is, especially at the time, the way people were hired into those jobs was they were hired with the idea of moving out of there pretty quick. So people mm-hmm. were hired with an eye for, do they know CG? Do they know rendering? And it was one of those things at the time. It was like a catch-22. You would go look at the websites, or you know, if these were very primitive websites of all the visual effects
what
companies.
What year is this?
This is 97.
97, okay.
And I mean, I knew I wanted to get into visual effects several years before that, mm-hmm. but that was when I graduated, and you would look at these websites, and they would say, to get a job, you needed a demo reel,
mm-hmm.
but you couldn't get a demo reel without working at one of these
without
places.
Without a job.
It wasn't that easy to just make a demo reel at home. And then, yeah. I mean, you had to have access to equipment to make a demo reel. I did have one piece that I was able to work on at school. And then even the process of getting it onto something that was showable was, I mean, you remember at the time, it was not easy to take digital images and put them on some kind of media, like a VHS tape.
I think there was a breakthrough that happened around, must have been about 2001 or two, when DV tapes came out. Do you remember that? And people were buying DV camcorders, and because you could plug a DV camcorder through a firewire to your computer, you could actually take whatever you had, put it on a DV tape, and then take that DV tape and put it onto a VHS tape. Because at the time, people were not burning DVDs or anything.
Yeah.
And now no one does anything. Everything's online.
Yes.
So there's demo reels are just like, go check out my Vimeo.
I have a thing. I have an idea for a product I want to put on like ThinkGeek or something, which is, I think the market for this would be really small, but it would be a VHS tape.
Yeah.
So you walk into an interview where you're going to show your demo reel, and you put a VHS tape on the desk.
And that's your product?
Well, and then you
the product is a VHS tape.
So you can fake out the interviewers.
Yeah.
And then when it's ready to show your demo reel, you flip up a secret lid on it, and it's an LCD screen, and you can show your demo reel.
Oh, nice. Yeah, nice, nice. Oh, okay.
I remember going into interviews with VHS tapes and stuff like that. But
yeah,
I mean,
and actually, what I also remember is back in the day, and I'm sure you know this too, is when you'd go to like the recruiting or HR office or whatever it was, and it was just a wall of VHS tapes.
Yeah.
And then you're like, you need a lighter? Hold on, just look through those first 100 tapes over there, and maybe you'll find a lighter that you like.
Right.
Those are tough days.
Yeah. So
getting a job at that time was really tough, and it still is.
It's just very, very different. But I mean, if you wanted, there were basically two ways to do it. You could either go through a much smaller company and probably get artist time right away if you started at a very small company.
Yep.
But if you wanted to work at ILM or DD or,
yep.
you know, it was really just ILM, DD, and R&H. You couldn't get a job as an artist right away, but there was an entire system to bring people in through entry-level jobs and then just get them into jobs. It was almost like a filtering mechanism.
I got lucky in the sense that I did a lot. I had demo reel material through my architecture job.
Yeah.
But still wasn't enough for me to have material that would get me a job at DD. So the only other thing that happened, and this is, you know, I hate to say it, but it's who you know.
Yeah, that too. Yeah, that is true.
And Eric Hansen was the one who basically went to the big stack of VHS tapes and goes, oh, this one, and pulled it out and goes, we should check this one out. And he knew me, and he's like, this guy would be good for this job. And so that's what eventually happened. And that's the only reason, and I don't want to blame the people for like, oh, well, we don't know. It's like, that's how saturated the market is.
Yeah.
And there's only so many jobs out there. And so it's a little bit tough. Now, like I said, things have changed now. People now just scour the internet and find people that way.
Yeah. Well, I mean, just you can do what you can do work that's orders of magnitude better than what we were doing at these high end companies at home.
At home. So right. Right. I mean, back then it was like, you pretty much almost needed an SGI or a $30,000 workstation to do anything.
Yeah. Well, the thing that was cool about ILM at the time as well, and I'm sure it's still true, is there was a huge culture of training and of teaching. So, there were a lot of presentations in theater, room of very experienced artists showing how they did stuff, and every single person in the company was welcome to go. Mm-hmm. And so I would just, every chance I would get, I would ask my supervisor, "Hey, can I go off to this thing?" And it was always, unless if there was something urgent going on, it was fine. And so you would attend these sessions and learn about, you know, green screen keying from people who'd been doing it on film since the late 70s. They've actually been pulling, you know, optical mats and then made the transition to digital, and they were teaching how they did keying. It was amazing. So that was a great opportunity. And so to get back to the Galaxy Quest thing, so Galaxy Quest, the stuff that ILM did and then I helped on was, one thing was the Demon Babies, which is interesting because the Demon Babies, there's this scene where they're these cute little blue pot-bellied little aliens, and they come up and say, "Oh, they're so cute," and then they bare their teeth and they're like these, like, they look like little demons.
Right.
That was pretty much my first experience with digital creatures.
Right.
And it's really interesting how some things have just come so far since then, but some things are also still kind of the same. I mean, that was a blend shape rig. I mean, the way they did shapes at the time was completely different. And ILM had its own custom shape system, but it was still basically, you could think of it as, as a blend shape rig. And, you know, they were still there. Faces. I mean, faces are really, really, really hard. And this, I mean, you know, we talk a lot about shading and lighting and stuff like that, but I still think the geometry is really the hardest thing. I think shading is kind of, and lighting has kind of been solved for the most part.
I think it's solved, but it's misunderstood. I think that there's some people who just most of my experience, right? And we can talk about it at some point, but you and I have worked on faces for a while, and we have a way that we thought about how a face needs to come together and what the shaders need to look like, etc. But even at DD, it was like you go from one artist to the next artist, and their textures were completely different.
Yeah.
And the way they assembled the shader was completely different.
Yeah.
And you and I have thought about this for a long time, where we've been doing it right. And but then I was talking to, you know, some other artists in the Digital Human League, and they were like, yeah, and they showed me their shader network. I was like, whoa, that is completely different. And so there's reasons for why they do what they do and they work certain ways, but this shouldn't be necessarily, anyway, we can talk about that.
It's interesting. I agree. And I think when I say it's been solved, just to clarify that statement, it's sort of like, you could think of it as like a resolution type thing, meaning you don't need to render an image finer than the resolution that you're ever looking at it. Right.
Right.
And with faces, so everything is an approximation, right?
Sure.
And we're rendering these digital faces to a certain extent that you're seeing with your eyes, you know, from so many feet away on a screen that's so big. And I think it's been solved to that approximation. I mean, if you take, and some of the stuff Paul Dubevic has done and some of the stuff we did at DD, where you take photographs of a face and you go so close that you're at like a macro level.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, no one is really doing the kind of stuff that's really happening on skin at that level. You just don't need to. I mean, or at least for the 99.9% of anything that's ever been rendered with a face, you know, we don't need to worry about that stuff.
I'd say that that's arguable in terms of the specular.
It does. The microscopic features do have macroscopic effects. And so yes, I agree with you in that sense that the microscopic features of a face can affect how you perceive it at a macroscopic level.
Mm-hmm.
I think there is still work to do there.
It's definitely something we're saying. Are you going to be a member of the DHL or not?
Sure.
I think, yeah. Because you and I have talked about this for a long time, and I know you've been really busy and you're trying to focus on getting things going on your new job, which we can talk, as much as you feel comfortable with. But I'd love to be able to, when you're ready for it, you can offer so much on the discussion point of this that it would be really cool to have. And I'll tell you more about it later. But yes, I'd love to have you as part of the Digital Human League, because we've done so much and thought about it a lot. And so I actually need someone on my side too.
Sure.
All right. I don't want to go too far into the rabbit hole. I still want to talk
the
about your
rabbit
past.
Hole.
Yeah. Yeah. But I want to talk about, okay. So you were at ILM for a while. So you worked on Galaxy Quest I said you were render wrangler on Phantom Menace, right?
Yeah.
And then what were you doing after that?
There was a department at ILM that I think it hasn't existed for a long time now. I'm not sure about that, but it was called the R&D TD group. And I still think it was one of the best departments that I've ever seen at any company, because I think there's really a big need for a department like this at every company.
Sure.
It was an officially recognized department of TDs. And ILM has always used the word TD a little differently than other companies.
Yeah, we should basically clarify for those who don't know. A TD means technical director, but it's very confusing. Most people think they're a director. Like if you go outside of the VFX industry, people think, oh, you're a director. No, it's not.
Right. And even within the VFX industry, the other companies mostly use TDs to refer to like sort of pipeline programmers.
Right. And then places like Sony refer to TDs as pretty much everyone as a TD.
Yeah, and like ILM too. So all shot artists, all CG artists are TDs, but you were basically, and at the time there really was no strong distinction between lighters and compositors and effects.
Really?
Every person was expected to be able to light, run effects, and composite, and people had different strengths and all of those, but there was not so much specialization at the time. So if you were a TD, you were a CG artist, but there were certainly modelers and texture artists and animators. There was always that division, but
as far as shot
production, like back what they call back end now was just TD.
Mm-hmm.
So there was this group called R&D TDs, which it was sort of an officially sanctioned group of TDs who could spend 20 to 50% of their time also doing R&D work. So it was okay. It was recognized by the company that you might be spending some of your time doing development work for other shows or for facility level stuff that would benefit all shows.
Right.
Usually so you were on a show, but
so your workload was reduced in order to give you enough time to do some other stuff.
Yes. But you were still an artist on shots. You were still running shots too.
Right.
So, because I come from a CS background. So I love programming and I love getting down and dirty and actually writing code.
Yes.
But I also love doing the actual CG artist level work.
Production stuff.
As well,
yeah.
Production work. So, and really that's kind of how I fell into this business, was because I had a really strong love of computers and a really strong love of film.
Right.
And I always say it was like the Reese's peanut butter cup. It was like, oh, you can have film and computers in the same job.
It's the perfect blend of art and science in a way.
It is,
And you really have to be very good at both. You can get away with being mostly art now because there is always a strong support team to help you.
Yeah, the technical support and the software, off-the-shelf software, is so good that you don't.
You can get away with being mostly an artist. Let's just say what it is. I mean, I've known animators that can barely use their email,
Right.
But they're really good animators and they have really great tools and they're incredible and they're really fast, et cetera.
Well, the other thing I see a lot, I've seen this countless times over the years, is someone who has no technical background who just starts doing CG from an artist side and says, particle system, that's interesting. And then they end up writing like the best, voxel renderer you've ever seen. Like people just stumble into this.
That's what happened with Alan when he wrote Voxel Bitch at DD. I'm pretty sure. I mean, that's like,
yeah, that was before my times, but I've seen that happen in many cases where someone just says, I think I'm gonna pick up this this programming side, and then they just blow everything away that's ever been done. So sometimes you just need someone to come in with,
because they think differently. I think
they have a different
well.
Perspective. It's yeah. true. But so that was really the perfect mix for me at the time. So and yeah, I worked on Perfect Storm was a big show at ILM at the time, and then Episode 2 started, and right. I was on that for 2 years. And basically, well, one thing that happened during the Phantom Menace was that most people will remember the same summer. In fact, I can't remember if it was a few weeks before or a few weeks after The Matrix came out.
Oh, right.
And so everyone going into that summer thought it was going to be the year of Star Wars. And then, you know, anyone who sat through The Phantom Menace and sat through The Matrix, you know, the only thing you ever thought of for the rest of the year was
The Matrix. Yep.
So
that was an important movie.
That was a very important movie. Yeah. And so they were working on the sequels, across the bay in the Bay Area. And mm-hmm. that was a big draw for me at the time was okay, I think I want to get involved with the Matrix stuff. And, that was a great experience. That was at ESC Entertainment.
Right.
And that's where I met Kim Labrary and a lot of other people that I've continued to work with over the years.
Right.
And so that
Stephen Parker was there.
Steve Parker, Tadao. Yeah. Tadao.
Tadao, yeah.
Yeah, Tadao was there. And there's a lot of people from that company who've gone on to do really, really great things.
Now, that was a different pipeline. I remember specifically what made it stand out or what they were sort of advertising as making them be different than the traditional ILMs, et cetera, is that they had a different look to everything. Everything looked very different. And there was a sort of this push of this mental ray at the time, right?
Yeah.
Mental ray tracing as opposed to scanline stuff, right? So things looked crisper and shinier and not as soft and stuff that you normally get in the scanline renderings that was going on.
I mean, there was just a mindset in the CG industry at the time that you couldn't ray trace. And ILM had done a lot of dabbling with ray tracing, and I was actually a huge mental ray user. Mm-hmm. And was using it. I mean, obviously ambient occlusion came out of the mental ray side of ILM. That was right. And but there were shows that were running full mental ray renders, not just ambient occlusion. Or the original occlusion pass was reflection occlusion. That was on speed too. That was before my time, but that was where they developed reflection occlusion using mental ray. And there were some shows that were doing beauty renders in mental ray, but it was always hard because it was always a support issue because
it was an evil word. When you said I want to ray trace, and they're like,
well, even with there was that side of it, and there was also just the support side, because again, at the time, every company, almost all of their intellectual property as far as rendering was concerned was in their shaders.
Right.
And so if you wanted to support Mental Ray, you had to rewrite all of your shaders for Mental Ray. And there were people at ILM who did that a couple mm-hmm. times. But that's a lot of work. And then the shaders are moving forward in RenderMan, and then they're behind in Mental Ray. And
right.
And so, but yes, you know, if you use, even still, if you use a ray tracer and you're kind of just using it like RenderMan, but just tracing where you need to, then it wasn't really ray tracing.
No. And computers were, let's just, you know, let's be fair, computers were way slower back then.
Yes, but they definitely were, and it was.
But it was still possible.
Everything was 32-bit. There was no, you know.
Right,
it was,
and when that stuff was going on, architecture, I always say this, architecture was ray tracing everything and doing full global illumination, not ambient occlusion. They were doing full GI.
Yeah.
And they were doing this on the same computers, if not lesser computers, than the VFX industry.
But the render times were pretty long.
They were long to some extent. Yes. When let's go back even, you know, mid 90s or early 90s, back then people were using Lightscape, and Lightscape was the 30 hour.
Yeah.
But they were baking lighting pretty much.
Lightscape was a very interesting renderer because it was a radiosity
render, yeah, which, and it rebuilt the geometry, so it actually baked in the lighting into the geometry, and the lighting was a vertex light, so it remeshed everything according to the lighting, and then every vertex was a light.
The thing that's so cool, I actually have been meaning to ask Vlado about this, about radiosity rendering, but the thing that the way a radiosity renderer works, essentially, like the fundamental algorithm,
sure,
is that it takes every surface, because if you think about global illumination, where light is bouncing off one thing and then bouncing off another thing, and then, you know, we typically emulate that in renderers with tracing, right?
Right. We trace,
and then you
those
set the number of bounces and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And the way radiosity works, and it comes out of, like, you know, heat transfer study, you know, of which is a rigorous, you know, scientific engineering,
right,
you know, area that's been around for like 100 years.
Yeah.
It's basically it's an absolute solve of the transfer
of energy,
of the energy between all the surfaces.
It
so
is.
There's no tracing.
There's no bouncing. No,
the only approximation is how fine you mesh the surface, yes, to run the solve. But it's running like
think
set
about
of
who
simultaneous
developed
equations,
right,
and then it's solving the equations, and then that is the, so you get the most beautiful results, because yep, it's the real, I mean, it's as real as the input that's been modeled and put into it,
yes,
is.
Well, think about who it was designed for, right? The way that Lightscape was designed for wasn't designed for CG people as much. It started off really as a way for lighting designers who are designing interior architecture spaces,
right,
to figure out the exact amount of energy of light that's being going around here. It's not go like, oh, I'll just stop bouncing. You're right. I mean, so when you do a radiosity render in Lightscape, you would not just get your render, because it actually gave you a mesh that you can move around.
Yeah.
Because it was solving that. And you could actually change the view to not just lighting, but heat intensity.
Right, right,
so
right.
You could figure out all of the energy that was put in the room. And this was a long time ago, mid-90s.
Yeah.
And some of those baking, as you said, would take, you know, 30, 60 hours,
yeah,
or whatever. But you could do several cameras, and then it would just do a scanline render of whatever you're doing.
Yeah, yeah. And it didn't, that also, that didn't really handle specular, so.
No, it didn't handle specular.
Yeah, so there was that too.
There was that too, but it was an interesting, it was an interesting way of working. But yes.
But the point is, yeah, there was a lot of that stuff happening, bubbling up through the 90s, but there was still sort of a dogma in visual effects that, well, you don't want to touch that. And you know, to be fair, like you were saying, it was mostly true, because of, you know, the throughput that any visual effects company has to put out even every single night.
Right.
You couldn't really touch that, but it was starting to catch up. The technology was starting to catch up, and I think there were people that said, no, it's time to start doing this. And, you know, and it was a transitional era. It was a transitional era.
Right.
And
the other thing was, I remember the other thing that just boggled my mind was this space was always at a premium, so much so. We did Day After Tomorrow on less than 2 terabytes of data, the whole movie. And that's just insane. And it used to be a facility would have 2 to 4 terabytes of data, and that's how much they could do any movie in.
Yep.
And that, so it was a big pain in the butt.
Yeah, but I remember at the time, pretty much every render, when you ran a render, you overwrite last night's renders.
You
wouldn't write multiple versions of render.
No, I think there was a rule that you can only keep 2 versions online, and then everything else was backed away.
It was considered like a major decision to keep a version of a render and not just overwrite it the next night. It did occasionally happen, but you know. And then the comper would just rerun the comp. They didn't have to change their paths. They would just rerun the comp.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
With the latest renders. But disk space was tough. Everything was tight. But
so anyway, you were at ESC, and so you got involved in the Matrix series. I guess you did 2 and 3.
I came on at the beginning of 3.
At the beginning of 3.
Yeah, the beginning of 3. Yeah.
And what was some of the big things you were working on then?
Well, I was on the Siege team, which was the sequence that's in Zion.
Okay.
With the underground sequence. And the main thing was working on the, it was this big battle sequence. And then there were these things called APUs, which, showed up again very similarly in the Avatar.
the big moving things,
yeah,
with the guns on
the moving, yeah, the exoskeleton robot, yep, things.
Well, that was from Alien too,
right? And that, yeah, Alien really was the
start of
the
that
original one. So we worked a lot on those, and what else do we write? There was, I mean, it was there was large environments as well. Large CG.
Did you do any character work at that time?
I didn't on there were some very primitive digital doubles, but that wasn't really doing any character work. And I was, because there were people in the building doing very interesting character work, obviously, on all the Agent Smith stuff and all the guys who worked on UCAP, and, you know, which just won the SciTech Oscar, you know, 15 years, or not quite 15 years. Yeah, I guess they started to work on UCAP in 2000, so it's like 15
years. Can you explain
later.
That to people?
UCAP was the system they use for facial capture for the hero digital doubles on the movies.
Okay.
So like Agent Smith, and I think the two main ones were Agent Smith and Lawrence Fishburne's what's Lawrence Fishburne's character again?
Morpheus.
I can't believe I forgot that. And so again, it was one of those things that I would always go over to those, you know, talk to those guys, like, and I just talk to them about how they were doing stuff. So I picked up a lot by osmosis, from being around that work.
Right.
And like, I remember
it's kind of a
talking
little,
to people going, so how, because I heard that they were doing something to simulate light going through skin.
Uh-huh.
I remember thinking, I guess you do kind of need to do that, huh?
Yeah.
At the time, people would do digital doubles and weren't even really thinking about subsurface scattering.
Right.
And,
I remember getting away with a lot of digital doubles where it was just a skin shader on a blend or something.
Yeah. Know? So they were doing subsurface scattering at the time, and again that was definitely,
and back then you really had to ray trace it.
They were doing it in like UV space.
Oh
yeah,
I remember. Well, I remember on day we were, well, we never did anything with it because ILM got it doing because of the whole debacle on that thing. But I was, before the show went away. We had been working on the snowy, frozen New York, and we'd been working on the ice, like a building that's covered in ice, and getting the proper subsurface on that ice. And we came up with all kinds of weird hacks that involve, you know, caching some data, not semi ray tracing it, and then reusing that data to be able to look at it. So it's probably something similar that you guys are doing.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. There were a lot of hacks. I mean, that's where I met Tadao and Masuo.
Uh-huh.
And those guys were working on that stuff a lot as well. So
was Kim Liptrap working with you when
she was there? Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think she was working on the thousands or 100 Smith battle or whatever. That
yeah.
was.
Yeah.
She was great.
Yeah. I'm not sure what she worked on, but then I worked with her again
on Constantine. DD.
Yeah. Well, and actually at DD too.
Oh, she was at DD again.
Yeah.
Okay. Cause yeah, I worked with her on Stealth and then I guess she left. She must've come back or something.
Cool.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So after you'd worked on the Matrix 3 and then you'd done some stuff on Constantine as well. And then after that, I guess ESC was closed.
Yep.
And so,
that was my first, experience with the visual effects.
Bankruptcy.
Yeah. Well, it was more, that was just the owner, which was Warner Brothers, decided to close it.
Right.
Because they didn't think it was a good business venture.
A shocker. Yeah.
Yeah, that was definitely the. I say you haven't cut your teeth in this industry until you've been through two company shutdowns. Yeah. One isn't enough anymore.
Well, we've been through one. You just happen to be resurrected
right,
into a different company.
Right. Yeah. So exactly.
Yeah. So okay. So then I guess we went to DD, and then
I went to Sony.
Yeah. Well, that's right. You were telling
me
because
you and I moved to LA.
You and I were at Sony around the same time, and I just didn't realize.
Yeah.
That.
I don't think we didn't meet.
No, well, it was when I was there, it was 1,000 people at Sony.
Yeah, I'd always say at Sony, it didn't seem like the building was big, mm-hmm. but it didn't necessarily seem so big until there would be a fire drill, and then you would go outside and there would be a sea of 1,000 people, and you'd say, wow, there's that many people in the building.
Yeah.
And you would see these people you didn't know.
It's not so much like that anymore right now. But.
Not in LA.
Right.
In any case.
but it was huge. I was working on Ghost Rider, and I was kind of isolated in my very posh cubicle that they allow me to have. And I sat there, and I just did my shots, and then I got very bored. But you were working on Spider-Man?
I worked on Spider-Man 3.
Spider-Man 3.
Yeah.
Okay.
I worked on a lot of threes. Let's see. Well, maybe just.
So Spider-Man 3, which was obviously the Sam Raimi's coup de grace in terms of what he was doing. I know I heard that Nerdist podcast where he was like, that's the one thing I get a lot of crap for.
Oh, I really? I never heard
But I remember one of the big things, I mean, there was a lot of research going on in Spider-Man 3 at the time because I remember Sandman was like kind of a big deal. There was some new software being written for Sandman at the time.
Yeah, I mean, there were people who had sort of flocked to Sony for that show from like a lot of different companies.
Yeah.
There were people from ILM. There were people from DD. Bunch of people from DD.
Yeah, a bunch of people. I remember there was a lot of Houdini artists.
And R&H. There was a bunch of guys who came up from R&H as well. So it was the gathering of like the knowledge spread. That was my first real experience of like the knowledge spreading between all the different companies, because the companies at the time that was starting to change like around then or even before then, but companies were very insular, where you would work at a company and you didn't really know much about how people did stuff except at SIG. You go to SIG Graph and then
I had experienced that from people that had been at Sony for a long, long time, because it was my first time when I went DD was my first VFX job, and I went to Sony. And it was already a DD. I was thinking, why are they doing things this way specifically? And they're like, no, that's why we've always done it and it's always been fine. And then I went to Sony and it was like, it's completely different. And then some people just didn't understand why would do anything.
It's sort of like in Europe, there's like valleys near the Alps where like there's these, towns of like 3,000 people and their languages just diverge.
Right.
Because like even though they're closer,
right.
They're... Without that communication, just stuff starts diverging.
Yeah. And I remember like when they were working on Burp, I was like, why would you ever do it this way? And it's like, that's because that's the way we did it back in the 90s and we've had no reason to change.
Oh, I mean, it's hard for a big company to change momentum. I mean, they invest every company.
They were just starting to develop Katana there at the time when I was there. And that was like the first time that I realized, we need something different.
Yeah. Yeah, that was I feel lucky to have been there at that time, because I thought that was a really great project, the Katana project.
Spider-Man 3 and Katana project?
Yes, Spider-Man 3 and Surf's Up, and there might have been some.
Surf's Up was the first one.
Well, they were at the same time. Spider-Man 3 and Surf's Up at the same time. So they were the two big rollout shows.
Right.
So I got to work closely with the developers of Katana from the artist standpoint, I was from the artist standpoint,
right?
Prepare that for rolling out to a show and then rolling it out to a show and training it. I think I at one point I counted in my career, I think I've used like 15 lighting tools,
right? including making your own,
right? So then when I got to DD, even before that, there were like two or three I used in the first couple of months I started at DD, but there was talk that we needed a lighting tool, and also we were starting to use Mental Ray for some shows at the time, so which didn't have any support at all. So I said, okay, I've used enough now, I think I know what I want, I'm just gonna start writing one,
right?
A lot of that came out of it was sort of like taking the best ideas from a lot of things that I use, and also just some companies can throw like a 5-person R&D team at their tools and at each of their tools and have those guys go for years.
Yeah,
this is sort of we knew we weren't going to have very many resources on this tool, so we just started throwing something together that we knew could work, but we would try to make it as useful as possible with the limited number of developers that we had.
So, I remember when the tool was called Atomic, and it worked inside of Maya.
Yeah.
And
it still exists.
I think when I first started using it, I was like, what the hell is this? And it was just very annoying to me. and I was like, yes, I know that basically it was a replacement for render layers in Maya in the most, if you're going to say it in one quick sentence.
Yes.
But it did a lot more than that. It also sort of allowed for other things. And what was cool about it, what ended up developing out of it, and ironically, there's some of the, it took some of the good things out of what I would say was in Burps and put it into that, because it allowed you to take what you were doing and then just script out everything so you, everything would be set up for you. You wouldn't have to manually do anything. And I think Blake Sweeney helped with some of that scripting stuff, right?
Oh, well, I mean, Blake Sweeney and Rito Trevino contributed a massive amount to it. And that we counted it up. There have been like 20 contributors to it over the years. So there's been a lot. It was a lot of people who...
It was really cool. It still is still is really cool. I mean, I don't know how much they use it over there anymore, but it's still an awesome tool.
I think it's still the main...
It's still their main tool, right? There's no reason for it not to be.
I mean, it's doing stuff. It's doing a lot of thankless things
right.
that if you don't have... You lose a lot of time.
Yeah. If you get it set up right and you have a good template and you have to have someone that knows how to make a good atomic template, which is not that hard to do. You just have to think clearly as someone who's done shots, and you can just bang through shots.
Yeah. Well, I mean that sort of came out of the Katana. You know, in Katana, they talk about recipes. You want to think of, if you're building a shot, what is the recipe for that shot, and then that way every single artist working on a sequence or on a show is handed the recipe and then they just cook it, you know?
Right.
And so it was the same idea that was inspired by that, which is this.
But I think the flexibility that I liked about Atomic is that while it had that recipe idea, it also operated inside of Maya. So that if something was broken and you had good enough, you know, had talented artists, which is the key to the thing, that artist can go, screw it, I can fix it. I can go in Maya, I can do this, I can change the geometry, I can delete things, I can modify whatever I need to do. I can make things happen. In Katana, you just have to kick it back to modeling or do this or do that. And there's just less flexibility in that sense, in the sense that, you know, it's a button pushing scenario, right?
I mean, I think that there's, and one of the reasons why every company has different tools is every company has different needs, which is like the kinds of shows they're running, the sizes of the crews,
and the experience level of the crew.
And so you have to design the tools to match the kind of work the company is doing. So when you're doing large CG features, there has to be structure. I mean, you cannot get out the number of shots you need for a CG
just by hand
without structure. The kinds of shows DD worked on counted on harnessing the individual talent of each artist to contribute. It wasn't the kind of show, like DD couldn't count on there being, you know, this huge setup phase where then every artist is just stamping out based on the setup phase. Like every artist was expected to add something to what they were doing, because basically the work was distributed throughout all the artists that were working on the show. So you had to keep some of the power in the artist's hands to
take advantage of the artist
and to take advantage of the artist.
Because I don't know how things have been, especially in the Vancouver office, because I didn't have much experience there, but at least in the Los Angeles office, it was mostly senior people who had a lot of experience cross board. And to take advantage of that person, you have to be able to say, we'll go lean here and let that person take over and do stuff.
Yeah. Exactly.
Like a Tim Nassauer or Daniel Buck, they can just bang through shots and just solve problems, right? And so that's where it basically alleviated the need for the TDs to make a very, very like robust lockdown system.
Right. I mean, it's nimble. It's sort of a trade-off. You can be more nimble.
Right.
And more flexible, but it's not going to scale as well.
No.
But because of the size of the shows that DD has traditionally done or was traditionally doing, it was more important to have that flexibility and that nimble factor than to be able to scale up to, you know, 300 lighters.
If you're gonna get you know 100 or whatever lighters that are out of school or whatever it is, and then you're like, you're just gonna have to hand them. It's like, here you go, here's what you do, and you do this, do that, and just run through the shots, and it's different now.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's kind of, I don't know if there's any other things you want to talk about with like the career path, but that was kind of the...
Well, no, that's arc. Not true, because there when you went to DD, what was the first thing you worked on over there?
Well, Benjamin Button.
Buttons. Okay.
Yeah.
And that, which was a huge thing, right? I mean, that was, I mean, everyone was kind of like saying, like, well, that was a really good show, but it was only one asset, right? It was just pretty much a head or whatever they're doing. But that thing was so well executed, so well done. And you guys did that in Mental Ray at the time, which was, again, another step for DD. That was a big one for them, right? They had been using V-Ray in commercials, and they had obviously most of their feature pipeline was done in RenderMan. And then you guys just like, we're going to do a head and we're going to ray trace it and we're going to do it with subsurface. And there was an HDR process pipeline that was really robust in terms of getting the proper image-based lighting and everything else. So that was a lot of the development. How much development did you guys do on that?
A lot. I mean, yeah. I mean, there had been some buildup prior to me arriving. There was definitely a sort of building up over a couple years, of Eric Barba running a couple shows. Basically, there was some commercials and there were some tests that they did over the year. So there was this.
I talked about that with Steve Preak. So those of you who want to know about that, go listen to the
basically,
Steve Preak podcast.
Basically, the sort of by the time the show was awarded and starting, there was this idea of, okay, we know the way we want to do this because of the sort of the trial and error that had happened building up to that. And that was sort of right when I came in. But there was a lot of interesting stuff. I mean, the shaders, every single line of code in the shaders was custom written. I mean, like practically even to the point of replacing low level stuff in Mental Ray. I mean, there was stuff that we were sort of bypassing and doing, like, we had our own Final Gather and we had our own,
right.
That was written by Jim Rothrock. Jim Rothrock and Tadao Mihashi wrote most of the shaders. From the lighting side, there was this whole effort that took place, by a group of us, because we were all in love with the idea of shooting HDRs, but we knew that a sphere is never really enough. There's artistic reasons you might want to move lights. I know there's been some discussion of this in the industry, like, is an HDR good, good enough, or is that the right approach even for lighting? But we always knew we wanted to start with the sphere, but start breaking out the individual lights from that sphere. And also, if someone's, typically an HDR is for infinite lighting. It's not for like localized lighting where it's changing throughout a space,
especially when someone's moving through that
something
space.
Especially in an interior, and if something's moving through that interior, so we created a system that you could open up Maya and you would see your HDR on a sphere, and then you would press a button, and then all of the lights from that HDR would pop off onto area lights in the exact location that those lights were on set, because our match move department surveyed every light on every lighting setup and got those positions for us. And then we also wrote custom shaders to drive area lights by HDR texture. So it was a high dynamic range rectangular texture on an area light.
Right.
And again, it's like now that's just what you do.
Right.
But there was no system to do that at the time. There weren't even any area light shaders driven by, in at least most of the production. V-Ray
had it for years before that.
I think I had a long discussion with Vlado about this once, and
V-Ray had this for years and years.
I think he, because
I remember they were talking about it on Iron Man. That was one of the things that frustrated me at one of the FX Guide podcasts. ILM was talking about, it's like, we created this amazing system that no one else has, which is to put,
well, images, every SIGGRAPH presentation ever given has said that.
Yeah, I know. But they're like, we've created a system. It's like, wait a minute. We had that back in 2000 in
V-Ray. I think their work was awesome. I mean, I think
there's no doubt about that. But everyone seems to claim about some level of technology that's invented. And it's always...
The thing is, if someone invents something, an atomic piece of something, but it never really... And I'm not commenting on V-Ray or anything, but I'm just saying, if you invent something but you don't come up with a system to make it usable, then it, in a way, it doesn't really matter whether you did it or not. So it's a question: is what can you build it in a way that can actually get used in production.
Well, it was being used in production, except that it wasn't being used by people that were doing VFX, because V-Ray wasn't big in VFX at that point.
Yeah.
It was used in commercials quite a bit. It was used in ArcViz, et cetera. But in big VFX movies, it wasn't until we moved over to Tron, right?
Yeah.
And so when we did on Tron, that's the first time I met you. That was the first time we worked on Tron together. And at the time, you were the head of lighting, weren't you?
I think so.
Yeah, but you were, because of all the work you did on Buttons, you were taking all of that very proprietary stuff that you guys have been spent years in doing for Buttons and putting it onto the Clue Head and applying that. And so most of that show was supposed to be done in Mental Ray. And then I came on because I said, we're going to do some V-Ray on this show. And that's when Eric and tried to get me into the show. And I went in there. And then slowly, a lot of the whole thing pretty much came V-Ray except for the heads. And it was very good reasons why those, because that's so ingrained. It would take so long to get a head to work in that system. To just redo the render would be a nightmare at that point.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, there were a lot of reasons, and a lot of it would take too long to sort of step through every single reason for going one way or another. But I mean, basically the general trend for everything in the industry, including in that situation, is that everything that was a specialized technology in visual effects has become available commercially.
Right.
So we were spending a lot of resources, meaning time and people, maintaining this suite of custom shaders, so you could do this and that and this and that. And it is very time consuming, and then Mental Ray releases a new version. And then because we're building stuff on top of that, if they change some of the lower level plumbing, then we have to redo
everything,
the upper level plumbing. And, and this happens to every company. And so if something comes along, and this is true anywhere in the system, you see this happen over the years with simulation systems and all across the board, animation, right, rigging. If something comes along that basically is doing what you were doing and maybe even is doing it better, and you don't have to maintain it,
right?
Then it's just a cost benefit analysis. It's like, let's stop wasting all this time. This is a solved problem.
Right.
It used to be that there were all these specialized problems, right, and there still are. But as certain things transition out of the domain of the custom solution within animation and effects companies into the commercial domain, other things still remain that need custom solutions. I mean, obviously, facial animation, rigging,
absolutely,
not entirely, but a lot of rigging stuff and muscles. Mm-hmm. these are the things where there are commercial solutions to a certain extent, but hair is another one. Hair is one of those constantly challenging areas.
There's not a general hair tool that really anyone can really trust.
So basically, I feel like over the years there have been these things that have sort of graduated out of.
Well, let's talk about that, because very specifically, especially on Tron, and it continued throughout the other V-Ray shows that were done at DD, is that there was a slew of TDs that were there to sit there and solve rendering problems that were going on, and the need for that level of technical ability had gone away, because a lot of those responsibilities were going on to Chaos Group. Chaos Group was basically saying, hey, let's help you solve these problems.
Yeah.
So it was pretty interesting. But I know you don't have that much time, but I want to go through and talk about, obviously, we've done a bunch of stuff after that. We continue to work on faces. We've done a lot of stuff, obviously moved over to V-Ray for a lot of the character work that was going on at DD, and that continued to happen, and we've covered that for a lot. But the last thing you and I worked on together was Maleficent, right? And then after that, I went to Chaos Group. But that was a really good show, and there was a lot of interesting stuff that we did on faces for that. How long were you working on Maleficent?
I think I was also on that for close to 2 years.
Yeah.
So I've done a lot of long 2 year shows over the years, which is, it's certainly common in feature animation, but
not as much.
Visual effects, a lot of people will just go.
9 months is usually about an average. 9 months, yeah. But 2 years is a huge amount of time.
2 years, but I mean, a lot of these things require a lot of, you know, these kinds of shows require a lot of R&D.
Okay.
So, yeah, I mean, Maleficent, and I gave presentations at SIGGRAPH this year about this, but Maleficent for DD was like the big graduation of V-Ray into the character realm.
Right.
So it was hair, skin, cloth, and it was stuff that had been, there had been shows that had used it for that, but this was like going all in on like a 550 shot show.
Yeah.
It was like close up faces
and there were developers and developers from
serious hair, like serious hairstyles.
There's a lot of developers from Chaos Group that came to DD to help solve some of the bottlenecks that were going on. And so Maleficent was really sort of the benchmark test for trying out, make sure hair was as fast and as good as possible. And it improved drastically over the course of the show. And that's basically what's in V-Ray 3 now, is because of the research that was done during Maleficent. You're now no longer at DD. Can you mention where you are?
So as with many people in the VFX industry, I became very, very interested in the world of VR.
Right.
Which it ties in with a lot of stuff that that I've done over the years as well. But I am a believer in VR. I know there are people who put on VR headsets and they go, okay, this is cool, but I don't really know.
But you think there's something that's going to fundamentally change about the way we think about
things. I think it will become ubiquitous, at least at the home level. I don't know about people walking around with goggles on the street, but and I think it might take a while. I think it could take potentially many years, you know.
Maybe, but you think
maybe it's 10 years, maybe it's 20 years, maybe it's less than that.
But you don't think this is going to phase out like it did in the 90s.
Right. I don't think it's going to phase out. I don't think it's going to be like stereo TVs.
Right.
In the recent round of stereo TVs where
right.
they try marketing it for 3 years and then they just go away.
Right.
I think it's just going to be a gradual growth, and the shape of that curve, I don't know what it's going to look like, but it will be a curve that's just always going up, mm-hmm. In terms of usage. So yeah, I left DD, for a company that we're still in stealth mode. So I'm not quite ready to,
but we can say that there isn't VR involved.
Yes.
Okay. And this is a passion that you have.
Yes.
And you know, maybe we can follow it up when we have more information, which would be great.
Yeah.
I would love to. I know that one of the people you're working with is also a friend of mine.
Yeah.
His name is Reiner, right?
Yeah.
And Reiner and I worked on Day After Tomorrow. He was modeling the ship on Day After Tomorrow back in then. So he and I know each other. So I'd love to do a follow up with you guys at some point. But just real quick, one thing that I think, because this does come up, and I was like, oh, great, another VFX guy in VR. But I think that there's so many good, talented VFX people working in VR that are starting to become dedicated to it, that I think it is that's going to be the thing that's going to change it. I think that there's going to be enough people that are like making great content, making great stuff, because there is that blend, right?
Yeah.
The art and the science that we talked about before. And then you've also, a lot of the people, and I know you're a big sci-fi fan.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And
science fiction and science nonfiction.
Science nonfiction, right.
But so, both.
Yeah.
Which I think there will be huge applications for VR for, you know, education, nonfiction type entertainment, and just fictional entertainment.
The cyberpunk movement was a very interesting thing to me. In fact, I just met one of my distant uncles recently, Rudy Rucker. He wrote the book Software and Wetware and those things. And he was one of the grandfathers of cyberpunk, which was about, you know, one of the software was about like
taking. What's a distant uncle?
Well, okay, I'll tell you. he is my mother and his wife are cousins.
Okay.
So that's basically what he is. And he's really cool. I remember reading his, my mom didn't know much about sci-fi at all. But she says, oh, you seem interested in sci-fi. You should read your Uncle Rudy's books. And I was like, who's Uncle Rudy? Funny. And so I started reading, I was like, oh, And software is like basically the idea is that you can download your brain and put it onto a computer and save it forever.
Right.
that was a long time ago that it was written. It was kind of interesting.
Yeah. No, I mean, well, that's coming eventually too.
Yep.
I don't know when, but.
Yep. So I think that there's a lot of interest in that. And I think the idea of like, what does VR really mean and the philosophy of it? And
well, the question is what is the compelling use case of it? But I mean, I think to the people who ask that question, and it's a completely fair question, the thing I keep saying is it reminds me of web browsers in 1994, where people would look at it and go, okay, well, that's
what
cool,
do I do?
What do I, yeah, why what do I do
have
with
to,
this thing?
Why do
what
I have I, to go to Ford.com? What's actually
right,
there? Nothing.
Right. What do I do with this thing? What's it for?
That's an excellent analogy.
And no. I just think it's going to be anything that was useful. Anything that the web became useful for, which is kind of unlimited.
Yeah, now it's everything.
Is what VR will become useful for.
Yeah.
Different areas will become more useful at different times. But
it's true.
I think the social aspect is going to be huge. I think the ability to interact with people is going to be huge. Mm-hmm. It raises all sorts of interesting questions of how that actually works. I think that, you know, all the stuff that's happened in the visual effects industry over the years with digital faces, digital faces will eventually, and again, it might take a very long time, but will eventually become ubiquitous.
Right.
You know, so
doesn't matter. You can make whatever face you want.
Right. It could be any face.
Yeah.
But because I think, and I say that because I think the most compelling case when you're in VR is the idea of being with someone there.
Experiencing it together.
Whatever the experience is. Maybe it's shopping. Maybe it's entertainment. Maybe it's education.
Right.
You know.
But it's that.
Like there's you know, yeah. Obviously the most sort of the most in the news book with the subject of VR these days is Ready Player One.
Which, yeah.
You know, they just announced Spielberg is going to direct
yep.
it. And this isn't a spoiler at all, but basically you learn very early in the book, there's this, basically VR school, like students don't even have to go into
the school right.
to attend it. You have to just be at your desk at home with your goggles
yep.
attending school. And there's, it explains in really interesting ways how that's actually enforced. I completely believe that that could happen. I mean,
I do too.
I think that will happen.
I think it already is happening, to be honest. In a sense
right.
that I think that people just aren't going to classes anymore. They're just basically looking at everything online and solving their
there problems. Is, but I think there is a huge. I think there is a huge lack of effectiveness of not
because they're not interacting with people.
Because they're not interacting. But if you're in VR and you can turn and you see everyone sitting there in the class and you see their faces and the faces are emoting, yeah. you know, what the person sitting at their desk at home is emoting. I mean, that's an amazing experience right
and
there.
And it's, yeah. And I think it's, I'll just use this analogy. My kids, we have a couple of little Android tablets and my kids are playing Minecraft on it. Right. And when they started the game, because they're on the same network, the way that the Minecraft thing works is like, hey, there's a game that's on your network and you can go into that game instead. And they didn't really know. Brady got in, you know, he's 5. He didn't really know what he's doing. He just pushed on a different game and he's like, wait a minute, who's that? That's Steve. And it didn't realize that that was his sister who was sitting right next to him. And their minds just blew. They just,
right.
and they were just, oh my God, what can we do? It's like, oh, and they started inventing games. It's like, let's go play hide and seek. And they were like hiding and seek and they were doing all kinds of stuff together. And I think that was a thing. It just like, instead of just being a game that they can play by themselves, they were interacting.
They were interacting. And of course, you know, it raises the questions of, well, you know, shouldn't two kids be just go outside and play? And I've been in conversations with people about that. And obviously, yes, they should, if they're
yes,
in
they
the same
should.
Physical place.
But their minds were really working and inventing things at
right.
that time, and they were
right.
inventing new things. And
you,
I think
you
that's
can't a, you, go outside and start building 100-foot tall structures with like blocks that are 2 foot wide.
Yeah, no, you can't do that. So, and they were doing.
Yeah.
They were inventing games.
Exactly.
And they're like, oh, let's do this, okay? And they were first, and they don't do that when they watch TV.
Yeah,
they're not using their brains as much when they're watching TV. So it was a really cool experience, and I think it'll be cool.
And I think it'll just, you know, again, for the connectivity of people on the globe, and it's such a generic term, but global village and everything. I mean, that's just going to become more and more a reality because you will be able to interact with people,
right?
No matter where they are. Like, I don't think we're gonna get Star Trek transporter anytime soon in the next 100,000 years.
Yeah.
But
you can go there virtually.
Exactly. That's gonna be the replacement for it.
But I think, don't you think, because they're not gonna want to actually see real things anymore, they're gonna want to see some Minecraft world or whatever the hell it is. You know, like something that someone else invented.
Yeah.
Might as well go there.
I mean, it's interesting because there will be virtual tourism where you could get a really interesting experience in another city or a famous spot around the world. But eventually what will happen is there's already kind of things like this in like Second Life, but no one really uses that much. But basically there will be spots you go to for virtual tourism that are virtual spots that never existed.
Yeah.
People are going to build, amazing cities or natural landscapes, or science fiction type.
Let's go see the set of Avatar and be on Avatar.
Or but I'm saying, like, you'll go visit to Pandora.
Pandora. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
Let's go ride some dragons on Pandora. That sounds awesome. I'll see you there.
It's like, people will talk about these, I'll call them cities, as if they were real cities. I mean, people will.
You know
what I'm saying? Like, I'm going to go on a vacation to New Venice or whatever.
I know. I mean,
and it's not going to be anything like any city on Earth.
I practically did that as well when I was playing Skyrim. I was like, I pretty much knew that town.
Right. And that's basically the gaming, actually, really the closest thing to that right now is games. I mean,
obviously. Oh, you know, is that also funny, just to recap that, is that some of the guys that were coming, some of our coworkers in Bulgaria would come to LA. And they would basically start walking around. It's like, oh, I know everything about here. I was like, really? He goes, yeah, Grand Theft Auto. Like, they knew LA from Grand Theft Auto.
Right.
So I think I'd love to follow up on this. We should definitely do a sequel to this because I think there's way more that we can discuss on the VR side. But I know you're short on time, so I'm going to let you go. But is there anything else you want to say to the users that are out there?
I think if you're interested in CG or feature animation or visual effects or VR, I think the field is wide open to anyone who wants to do it. I mean, it is.
And you don't have to work on a big feature film to be doing good stuff. There's amazing work out there doing that across a lot of fields.
It's a completely democratic field now.
Yeah.
Anyone can become a major player. A major player. You can, from an artist side or developer side, you'd be people writing influential pieces of software all over the world that all of a sudden start getting used. I mean,
yeah, be open-minded.
Wide open.
Yeah, be open-minded, and you don't have, it's like making it in the CG world doesn't mean you have to work on the next Transformers film. You know, you can work on anything. So,
yeah.
Cool. All right, I'm going to let the last bucket drop, and thanks so much.
Thank you.
And we'll do it next time.